everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Here with Dr. Sherry Siegel, looking at, investigating, checking out just about anything. Hoping that information and learning leads you to have a more positively minded way of being. But positive mind for many people could be very different. For some people, positive mind is suffering. You know, that's as positive as they get. If I suffer, I mean, I think the Buddhist recognized that all the world is about suffering. So if you could say a positive mind would be a mind free of suffering, that's true for some people. But for some people, deep romantics, you know, I don't know if they would know how to live without suffering. The people who you know who live with the, you know, always referring to the cup half empty as opposed to the cup half filled, who see, it seems as if angst runs in their blood and feeds them. Now, I think that's just a way of being. I think, why not? If you're going to have a positive mind, you may as well have a negative mind. You should be equal to it, you know. How could I judge you? But on that side of pain and people who like, who move towards what looks like the dark side of life, I've invited a guest. Our guest, Melissa Febos, F-E-B-O-S, who wrote a book called Whip Smart. And Sherry actually brought this to my attention. Sherry, this is interesting for you, isn't it?
It's something that I have no experience with and was really curious about it. I'm very looking forward to our conversation today because I want to learn more about it. And I learned a lot from the book. It's something that I would, in my day-to-day activities, not really have access to, and found it really, really interesting.
And when we talk about the book, we're talking about Whip Smart. So what does that conjure in your mind? Let's go right to Melissa. Melissa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Educate us, okay? What is Whip Smart about?
Whip Smart is a memoir about my nearly four-year experience as a professional dominatrix in Midtown Manhattan. And the book took place in my early 20s. I believe I started in 2001 and went to about 2005. So I was a senior in college and tired of making lattes, thought of myself as a writer, but knew it was not going to be easy to make a living at that right out of college. And I answered an ad in the Village Voice that made it clear that the job I was applying for was a sex work job, but that there was no sex involved. And it was, the job description was, they used the word dominatrix, but it was described as a erotic role play. I didn't know what that meant, but I showed up and was hired almost immediately. And for the next 3.5 years, I basically acted out the sexual fantasies of men. There was no intercourse involved, but they were all based on sort of an S&M model. In most of the scenes where I played sort of iconic, powerful female roles to my clients, involving humiliation and sometimes nurturing, but I almost always played the dominant role until about later in my experience, 3.5 years, when I sort of started experimenting more with playing the submissive role.
So what you did for a living during those 4 years and what your book is about the experience of being a dominatrix. Could you give me a good definition of that word, dominatrix?
I would say that a dominatrix is so odd that hasn't actually, you know, to sum it up in an elevator pitch, it's a sex work job that does not involve sex, wherein you act out the erotic power dynamics of your clients.
It's good. I'm getting there, but it's great, isn't it?
It's
that we have a word that we all kind of understand. We could all see somebody wearing a leather leotard and have a whip in their hands, right? And very high-heeled shoes, I imagine. And there's some guy on the floor, and we say, well, she's a dominatrix.
Yeah, it's a word that conjures an image much more quickly than it conjures a definition.
Good.
I think.
Well said.
So what's the image? What kind of image did you portray?
Just as he gave us, sort of a woman in a corset, very sort of sharp makeup, stilettos, kind of beautiful, angry face. It's an empowered image, and which is part of why I was drawn to it, you know, which is not typically what you associate with sex work.
Mm-hmm. The definition, according to Wiki, of course, where we find everything, is a woman who takes the dominant role in bondage and discipline. Bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, and BDSM. Mm-hmm. Now, could we take a moment and go over those three?
Yes.
Bondage and discipline. What does that mean?
Bondage and discipline. Bondage is tying up with rope or cuffs or any other sort of implement. You could tie someone up with a straitjacket, rubber ties. I used all sorts of things. And discipline, I'm not sure exactly why these are always sort of spoken as a couplet, but I mean, discipline basically means the same that it would in any other context, except it happens to be in an erotic scene where it's sort of, there's training involved, there's reward, and there's punishment if requests are not filled. And so it's sort of acting out that model.
So it could be bondage alone, mm-hmm, with no discipline.
Yes.
It could be discipline with no bondage.
Yes.
But like you said, they put the two together. Bondage and discipline. It's kind of an interesting thing. Now then, there's another couplet, which is dominance and submission.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different?
Dominance and submission, I think, just refers to that sort of paradigm where one person is giving the direction, is administering the punishment, is giving the rewards, and the other person is playing the submissive role where they're following direction or defying direction and then being punished. You know, as the dominatrix, you're almost always in that dominant role, and your client is almost always in the submissive role.
In the early 80s, there was a book written by a friend of mine, Peter Hogan. And in this book, he talked about the bondage. He talked about dominant submissive roles in marital relationships. And he said there's always one person who is in charge, is basically what he saw. And he saw that, he said, in every relationship, if you look real closely, you're going to see one is submissive and the other is dominant. He said there are flip-flop variations of it. There are times that they switch the roles. But if you look real closely, mm-hmm, you'll find that that same person is always in charge, even if they're in charge from weakness,
mm-hmm,
even if they're, mm-hmm, dominating, mm-hmm, from the weak spot or topping from below.
So in other words, you can have...
Which was the original title of my book, was Topping from the Bottom, actually.
Really? That would have been interesting because you weren't doing it.
I was in love with that title, actually, but they thought it was too obscure.
Topping from below really means being in charge when being submissive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the passive-aggressive.
Right.
Right, the one who is the victim all the time.
My most infuriating clients.
They would infuriate you.
Were the ones who topped from below, yeah, who wouldn't.
Because they controlled you.
Because they wouldn't let me do my job, yeah. Because it was essentially a manipulative role. I mean, I don't enjoy passive aggression in any sort of form in my life, and I didn't enjoy it there either.
Well, it's kind of interesting because what you would be saying is, if somebody's topping from below, what they're basically saying, they're saying to you, like, I remember one guy who said he would go and he would hire somebody and he would call them mommy.
Mm-hmm.
But if they didn't say boy right, he would have to keep training them. No, you got to, mm-hmm, say boy,
mm-hmm,
not boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he would keep training. And I would say, well, who's in charge here?
Yeah.
He said, well, I'm paying, so I'm in charge.
I know. That was the big revelation for me in that job, was that actually I found myself feeling much more in the submissive role, even though I was enacting the role of the dominant one, because many of the clients who come to see a dominatrix are not overall submissives, which by my definition means that you might have specific fantasies that you're attached to, but your real turn-on and your real obsession is just playing the submissive role. Whatever form that might take, you'll find some enjoyment in it, and really sort of accommodating the desires of your top, of your dominant. But I would say that at least half of the clients who come to see a dominatrix are not overall submissives, but they have a submissive fantasy that they want to pay someone to enact with them, and so they end up fulfilling that role of topping from below, because it can be very specific and scripted exactly the way they want to be dominated.
Yeah, the book about the Mayflower Madam, mm-hmm, what she talked about is the highest percentage of people that she had who wanted a dominatrix, were people who are in power positions.
Absolutely.
There's something about that goes together. Do you have any idea why men who act out, or people who act out significant power, I mean, I've just asked for it as an idea, because as a shrink, I should possibly define it.
Yeah.
Why do you think they want this moment?
I mean, I have my suspicions. And
what do you think?
Well, you know, early on, I would have had a more general answer, which is that I think that all people have some sort of balance within themselves of wanting to be in control and wanting to relinquish control, and that if you are in control in the vast majority of the time in your life, then that other part of yourself that seeks to relinquish control is going to look for an outlet and a place to sort of to find that balance. And so a lot of them would come see me. I mean, I would have stockbrokers who would come in their Armani suits, and they wouldn't even, I mean, the erotic component wouldn't even be mandatory for them. They would say, I'm so tired of telling people what to do. Just tell me what to do for an hour. Like, tell me to walk in a circle and it'll be such a relief. And then, you know, sort of later in my experience, it became my own experience that after I was, I started to notice how the ways in which I was trying to assert control and manage everything in my life and have control over other people, which I think was really sort of a fear-based instinct. Underneath that desire for control is so often an even larger desire to relinquish control, I think. And that's sort of what I come to now when I think about it, is that these are people who were very fearful and very much afraid and wanted to be taken care of, or who hadn't been taken care of when they were children or whatever. And so they wanted to exert this control over the world because it made them feel safer. But underneath, they really wanted to be taken care of.
Fascinating. Fascinating how well you understand it, Melissa. You know, and that's what I like about the book. The book shows your insight is more than just graphic detail. I used to have a couples would come for counseling, and I had a rule for couples. You'd love this, Sherry. This is what I would do, is I would say, okay, so your assignment is to go home, and for one night, one of you is going to be completely in charge, and the other will do only what the other person says. You will not read a book. You will not watch television. You'll sit in a corner and wait for a command. When you get the command, you will do whatever they say. Now, they may want you not to sit in the corner. They may want you to watch television with them. Whatever it is, you're doing what they say. And then the following day, you don't discuss it. And then I want you to wait 2 days, 2 days in between. Next day is normal. And then you switch the roles. Invariably, what came back was the person who played the submissive role talked about the ecstasy of being free of all responsibility. And it would manifest like this. The guy would say, he would tell his wife, make dinner. And she said, what kind of dinner? And he would say, make a salad. And she would say, well, what should I put in the salad? In other words, she just said, I'm not going to take any responsibility. You're going to tell me what to do. And he told her exactly what to do. And she felt free as a bird.
Mm-hmm.
Free.
Mm-hmm.
She said it was that. And then in the reverse role, the men would report the same. So that kind of validates your perception that probably everybody wants a place where they could just lay back and say, do me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like, I'm curious, actually, your clients mostly men, because it seems in day-to-day life, men are often in roles of control where they're giving the orders, they're the bosses, they're in the places of control and power.
Right, and I totally agree. My clients were almost exclusively men. Occasionally I would have couples, but even in those instances, it was almost always at the whim of the man who wanted to come see me. And while I do think that, I mean, partly my most usual line for this is that women don't usually have to pay to be dominated. There's plenty of areas in life where we can find that for free if we need. But I do think also that our culture is much less forgiving of men who are clear about their desire to give up control or to play a submissive role. We're pretty strict about that culturally, as much as we like to pretend that we're not anymore. And so I think that for men. And I think also there was something about the arrangement of paying for it that made it feel more private and gave it a business element to it, so that it felt safer for men, for it to be a total stranger. And a lot of these were men. And it's possible that with their wives or their lovers that they might have been able to explore this, but their fear was so great in exposing that desire that I think it really created sort of a very controlled space for them to explore it in.
They had to hide it in a dungeon, and as I understand, mm-hmm. that's where you worked, a dungeon?
It's true, and I know that the word dungeon sort of evokes a basement with chains and glistening walls, but it wasn't actually like that at all. It was the third floor of an office building in Midtown Manhattan, right near Bryant Park. And it was actually quite beautiful. Huge, like 10-foot ceilings and easily 800 square foot rooms. I think there were 8 rooms.
Is it still there?
Yes, it is still there.
The dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the dungeon?
It's called the dungeon. In the book, I call it The Dungeons of Mistress X, although that wasn't actually the name of it. But there are probably 10 dungeons of almost that scale in the city functioning today, although some of them have closed down, but close to that.
And what's a dungeon like? What does it look like inside?
It looks kind of like a little bit like an opium den, a little bit like a fancy hotel. When I walked into it, I immediately thought David Lynch. Because it was very sort of moody and very good lighting, sort of wall sconces, red painted walls, mirrors everywhere, oriental rugs, very sort of long hallways with lots of closed doors, sort of very sort of labyrinthine, lots of different rooms, and it took me forever to find my way around there. But the way that it sort of functioned underneath the surface was much more akin to just about any other kind of working environment you can find. Like, we brought our coffee in, we ate breakfast, we did laundry, we gossiped about our clients. Anywhere that you go for money, 4 days a week has a slew of common denominators.
Like a doctor's office.
Yeah.
Dentist's office.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had rooms that were actually more pristine than most doctor's offices I've been in.
In your work, when you're doing this work, you said sometimes they would gather and talk about the different customers. Mm-hmm. So, in effect, it was with disdain. You know, when you talk about it, and this guy wanted me to tie rubber bands around his nose, you know what I mean? It's like, even though there is no judgment, there is the judgment. I mean, it's like being a sales lady at Lord & Taylor. You know, you got customers, and you're going to talk about the customers, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was generally, when the women would speak to each other about their role, did they talk about the men with disdain?
Generally, yes, which is very controversial. Some of the, actually the only negative backlash I've gotten after publishing this book, which was very surprising to me, was actually from the BDSM community and from people who work in that job. Because there's sort of this, you know, it's a very intimate, personal, erotic, sometimes spiritual experience for a lot of people, but I worked in a commercial S&M world. And so I think that, you know, while I definitely had clients and whom I enjoyed their sessions, I respected them as people, I found them funny, and, you know, I felt affectionately towards them, for the most part, we did speak of them with disdain, because our job was to enact the sexual fantasies of other people. They were not our fantasies.
In addition, it's all part of the system, because if you talk about them with disdain, it's almost like you're fulfilling the job.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the men who come in who want to be in that position, and we're going to talk about that,
mm-hmm.
they want to be treated disdainfully. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Or is that just my imagination?
No, it's absolutely true.
Talk about what that would be like. What's the attitude that you walk in? A guy walks in and he says to you, all right, now what I want you to do is, that's not what they walk in with, right?
Occasionally they would, but for the most part they walk in pretty tentatively, and in the consultation they end up, and a lot of them sort of haven't spoken this stuff out loud very often. Regulars get much cockier in their requests, but if it was a new client, say, well, you know, I'm into verbal humiliation and face slapping and spitting, and sometimes they would have notes written out and they'd be kind of nervous. And it really, I mean, just sort of the, I don't know if it's irony, but the reverberations of sort of these desires and what they meant throughout this whole little model of the dungeon was really pretty staggering when it dawned on me how they came and they wanted me to mock the size of certain parts of their bodies, tell them they were worthless, tell them they were bad, that they were disgusting and pathetic and pitiful. And in the very beginning, I felt really nervous because I'd never enjoyed being cruel to people, and I didn't really feel in control. But after I'd been doing it for about 6 months, I did sort of develop a disdain for a lot of them, and so there was a moment where those sort of my feeling and their desire started to match up a little bit, and verbal humiliation actually became sort of my specialty.
you found that you were the people would know that you could, but you're very good with language. I could see it.
Yeah.
I could see it in your book. So you know enough ways of shaping words that might make them hurt to the quick a little more. Now, what would happen as you are talking to somebody in a disdainful way? And could you, without using the kind of expletive that would be bleated, could you give me an example of how you would talk to someone?
Well, a lot of them would sort of be interested in this kind of emotional narrative arc in their scenes where they would want me to, and it could go one way or the other, where they would want me to start off sort of sweet and flirty or nurturing and motherly, and then sort of have it build in a kind of crescendo where I ended up yelling at them, and this would often be sort of fit into this actual scene where I'm playing the mother, and I ask them to do something, they do it poorly, and I chew them out and call them every conceivable name I can think of, or specific names that they've given me.
We're speaking with Melissa Febos, F-E-B-O-S, pronounced, who wrote this book, Whip Smart, fascinating. If you would, Melissa, take me through a narrative as you're doing it.
Okay,
so do it. Imagine we have a customer. We have a customer who comes in who is paying you to do your stuff. Give me 5 minutes.
Okay. So I'm remembering a specific regular of mine who would come in, and we wouldn't even have a consultation because I just knew his scene. They would tell me he was there. I would go put on this outfit that was stockings, garters, a long striped skirt, button-up shirt, kind of a sexy office outfit. I'd walk into the room where he was. I would sort of strut into the room. He would be nowhere in sight. There's a bathroom adjacent to the room. I would pick up the phone on the wall, pretend there was a phone call. I would pretend it was the principal of my son's school, and I would say, you know, he did not. Again, I'm going to take care of this. And I would hang up the phone, and I would yell his name, Jeffrey, Jeffrey, where are you? And he wouldn't come out, and I would sort of storm around and then sort of assume he wasn't there, and then very slowly peel off my stockings, take off my shoes, and sort of half undress. And all the while, my client, Jeffrey, is in the adjacent bathroom watching me through a crack in the door, and I know this. And then after I'm undressed and I sort of, you know, this voyeuristic thing where he's just watching me, and then I hear a creak. And I storm into the bathroom and I discover him with a dirty magazine and a pair of my panties on, or a pair of woman's panties that are supposed to be mine on. And I proceed to grab him by the hair, slap him in the face, yell at him, tell him about the phone call from his teacher, which, maybe he was had dirty magazines in his desk. And then for his session was about 2 hours. So for a long while, I would basically chase him around the room, try to get him to apologize, spank him, and then maybe it would sort of culminate in me forcing him to show me the magazine and show me what he does with the magazine, and he would, pleasure himself. And then in the end, it would end with sort of a nurturing denouement, or I would sort of pet his head and tell him he was my good boy and this was never going to happen again, right? And he would, whimper and sniffle and say this would never happen again. And then at the end of it, we would sort of break out of character and he would profusely thank me. And he really saw it as his therapy. You know, he felt this sense, the same feeling that I have felt walking out of a really productive therapy session is how he described walking out of our sessions, which is that a weight has been lifted. He feels sort of lighter. He has more clarity. He has more optimism about things. And I saw him probably every other week, maybe once a week.
Fascinating. You know, as I hear it, Sherry, I'm thinking chemicals. You know, I'm thinking neurotransmitters. I'm thinking everything from testosterone to estrogen to everything I could possibly imagine is going on chemically as we build this tension. So let's build a chemical profile of what we imagine takes place from the minute she walks in.
Well, that's a great idea. It's an interesting way to look at it. The first thing that I see in that interaction is fear. And as fear rises, the fight or flight hormones, adrenaline, start to circulate, and people's hearts beat faster.
Okay,
and
but before the fear, he's in the bathroom peeking at her through through a window, you know, through a little crack in the door while she undresses. So that may, that could be the point he goes to. But if I were looking at the full chemical profile, I'd want to see what happens as he's on that floor. Is he afraid or is he naughty? And if he's naughty, what is the chemistry of naughty? What is that like? Is it shame? And what does shame really feel like? And where does it come from in our bodies? And when you're shameful, you feel a flush. And when you feel a flush, what is the chemistry of flush? And what I believe you are, Melissa, is I think you're a drug dealer. And I really think that what you do is you get people to the chemistry that they like, just like a therapist does. A good psychotherapy session is a drug dealer. Because what he's doing is he's getting a person to a state of mind where they feel in balance, which is as well chemical. So I want to go back to the beginning. At the very beginning, we have a young man, a person who's walking in with a significant amount of tension. He takes this tension, he pays for a room, he goes in a room, and he is now entering this infantile, naked, wearing panties, laying on a floor, becoming, I guess he's dropping all his testosterone down. I think he's trying, maybe he's picking it up, I don't know.
My thought is that this is a reward, that he's on the verge of, he's anticipating a reward, and so that dopamine probably plays a big part in the time that he's in the bathroom. Then possibly as you begin your derision and the hitting and the physical interaction, then maybe the fear comes up, and so the adrenaline. I'm sure the adrenaline is working throughout this entire interaction, and at the end you maybe think about oxytocin, the bonding chemical, where at the mother and child would bond, or a loving couple would bond. So it sounds like that might be the arc of the interaction.
Good. That sounds like the short stroke. The long stroke of it is how many different things can go on in this period of time. We talk about dopamine, and we know that dopamine is an arousal chemical that you could easily become addicted to in your own kind of way. You know, we have a new thing called dopamine squirts. Do you know about that? We were doing an interview with a guy about yesterday on obsessions. And he talks about how we squirt ourselves with dopamine. We give us a little jolt, and it's almost like somebody was taking a medication. And people become used to that. And eventually you get that your state of well-being, the oxytocin, is eventually directly hooked to dopamine squirts added to other things that take place. So here's what's happening. We have a person who is, instead of taking drugs, going to a room and through a series of acting out, like a rhinoceros would rub against a tree, you know what I mean? Through a number of things that you do to your body and your mind, you get your chemistry to a place where you feel at peace, a certain kind of peace. Now, that level of peace may involve pain, so the spanking, it may involve being hurt, it may involve it may involve, and then pleasure as well, then oxytocin as well. And then, of course, there's climax, mm-hmm. which adds to that as well.
Mm. I completely agree. I mean, and the book, you know, has these two narratives, and sort of the other part of it is about my experience as a drug addict and my recovery from it. And that parallel, as soon as I went into recovery and I kept doing this job for over a year after that, that became so apparent to me in so many ways, sort of the raised tolerance level of my clients, the compulsion behind it, and just what you're talking about, this growing sort of belief that their well-being is now dependent on this source of dopamine or pleasure or release or whatever it is.
So would there be, well, we're going to take a break in just a minute, but before, and we're going to come back, we're going to talk a lot more about this. So it's fascinating. You know, here we sit in judgment of people's sexuality all the time, and we're trying to judge them, you know, and will we judge somebody who runs around a track for 3 hours exhausting themselves, right? What they're doing, they're trying to get themselves in chemistry. Hmm. So if we suspend our judgment, perhaps we can learn more, as we always do. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, more of this fascinating stuff with Melissa Febos, author of Whip Smart. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. ¶¶ John Mondeville with Sherry Siegel, back with you with The Positive Mind, interviewing Melissa Febos, who's a fascinating person. I mean, she's the daughter of a sea captain and a Buddhist psychotherapist. Buddhist therapist?
Indeed.
Well, which one was the sea captain with your mother? It said, you know...
My father.
You're the I know, but it said you're the daughter of a sea captain and a Buddhist psychotherapist. Let's imagine your mother was a sea captain.
I know.
And your father was the Buddhist psychotherapist. That would have been an interesting thing.
It's
interesting
true.
Beginning to an S&M perception of the world.
It's so true. It's so true.
You're a feminist. And clearly you define yourself as a feminist. Now, here's a feminist doing stuff that many feminists, I'm sure, look at and say, what are you kidding?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I sort of shared that point of view when I started the job. Well, I shared that point of view about sort of sex work in general, or even sort of the experience of craving the desire of men, you know, wanting to be seen as a sexual object. And so for me, I saw it being a dominatrix as sort of a loophole in that ideology. You know, I was going to play the powerful role. I was going to be humiliating men. I was going to be dressing them up in, you know, provocative clothes and calling them names that women often get. It's sort of a lot of the scenarios in the dungeon were sort of a reenactment of very typical misogynistic models. But you know, after a certain amount of time there, I realized that, in a lot of ways it was incredibly similar to all sex work jobs in that I was doing what the paying client wanted and their fantasies just happened to be of a dominant woman. I didn't actually feel very empowered for a lot of those sessions. And so, you know, sort of later on in my experience, closer to when I stopped working, I really experienced this sort of vast disillusionment with the women around me, with my clients, with my own sort of definitions of what feminism was and what empowerment was, and I sort of got pretty honest that that's not what it felt like, and I felt like everyone was sort of a bunch of hypocrites, you know, that then a lot of them identified as feminists, and I didn't think any of them were, but then sort of my perspective has transformed once again, being out of it, and I think that, you know, for me, it was a job. I wasn't into it, and it felt humiliating in a lot of ways. And for me, that felt, in the end, disrespectful and like a betrayal of my own sexuality and my own beliefs. And so I stopped doing it. But I don't think that, even having had that experience, that that was an anti-feminist or unfeminist experience, because that is the only way I've ever learned anything, that I've ever learned how to, what was a betrayal of my own sexuality, or what my own identity was, or what I was comfortable with, or what felt humiliating or, you know, empowering to me. And I've since adopted a much broader definition of sort of feminism, which includes sort of the acknowledgement that I have no idea what anyone else's experience is. And I think that being a dominatrix may very well be incredibly empowering to some women, but for me, it wasn't in the end.
And so, Melissa, was this legal work that you were doing? And I'm curious to know, basically, you looked at this as a job. Do you think that sex work in general should be legal?
I do, because I think it's similar to how I feel about abortion, that it's going, regardless of my personal beliefs about it, it's going to happen, and women are going to get hurt. And if it's made legal, then that's less likely to be less likely to happen. It's going to be safer for everyone involved.
And has your experience, your own intimate experience, we'll say, dating people, changed as a result of your work?
Absolutely. You know, when I was in the job, I always claimed that it didn't affect my relationships because I was able to maintain them. And in retrospect, and really throughout the process of, you know, very thorough therapy and writing this book, I figured out that I very carefully selected my partner so that they would co-sign my sex work experience and not have a problem with it. I always knew throughout my tenure there that I would never have been able to accept that from my own partner. I would never be able to date someone who was the dominatrix. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but the way that it affects my relationships now, is that, I mean, for me, the experience of working with these clients, playing out these roles, it became this very sort of personal journey for me, wherein I became much more honest with myself about my own desires by the end, and sort of that relationship to power and submission and shame that we talked about at the very beginning, where you know, my clients were these people who had all of this power in their lives and really sort of, you know, clung tenaciously to that powerful position because underneath it, they had a very raw, deep desire to become vulnerable and were petrified of that. And I think that I fall into that category. And I sort of discovered that in retrospect after I left the job because, you know, the truth is, you know, every waitress in Manhattan would be spanking people if it were that easy, you know. And as much as it was a job for me, I think I did have some very deep personal psychological motives for being there that kept me there for 4 years, and that those were they.
Well, at this, the question I always have about having been a sex worker, is there, I don't even like the word sex worker. Mm-hmm. I wish we had better words for it, you know. But is there... Sex becomes something that becomes your trade, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sex is your trade. Now, even if you were interacting with clients for money sexually, with penetration and all that stuff, you must have known women who did as well. If sex is your trade, what does sex become when you're not in the trade?
Mm.
What is it? When you're, I mean, is it a thing? Is it anything? Is a kiss better than having actual... copulation?
Yes. I mean, interestingly, I think across the boards, all kinds of sex workers, strippers, taxi dancers, prostitutes, dominatrixes, almost nobody kisses their clients. And for some reason, that is, you know, protected as this sacred act wherein sex and wherein emotion and physical acts can become merged. Because I think for most people in sex work, you know, the sex act has to become on some level divorced from your emotions. Because it is your job, you know, and I think for me, I was able throughout most of my time in that job to have a private sex life in which I didn't often think about my work. And I think that it just required this very strict dissociation in my mind from sort of that kind of sex and this kind of sex. And it was very compartmentalized in my mind, like the different parts of my identity, the college student that I was and the dominatrix were totally distinct identities that I had. And that was required if I had more of a holistic sexuality that incorporated all of my emotions and I felt like the same person in all the different facets of my life, I don't think I would have been capable of doing that job. And I don't think anyone else would without emotional devastation.
Well, it seems almost trite, but what most people will say, most women will say, sex without love is meaningless, right? Well, that's what you would imagine, but it's not true. Sex without love could be very meaningful. Mm-hmm. So can swimming without a bathing suit.
Almost,
It was close. I mean, but it doesn't necessarily mean... So we have sex done a number of ways. One way sex could be done professionally, and sex could be done as a physical experience only, with a little bit of course attachment to it, and then sex and love go together.
Mm-hmm.
It's trite to say the best sex is when there's sex with love, because you could hear about a dozen women will say, and the guy on the shipboard who I just met one night was the best sex I ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Is your take on it after all of this time that affection is important with sex for you to feel that it's rewarding to you, or can you have just a purely sexual experience?
I think after all of this, I have learned that while I think I'm capable of sex without affection and enjoying that, it's unlikely. And that I've actually had a lot of sex that I claimed was great sex that was devoid of real tenderness, that I sort of, you know, I was very committed, and this was part of my wanting to be in control all the time. I can choose to have sex without love because, you know, having love and desiring tenderness is a vulnerable position to be in. So I was very committed to proving that I could just have playful, fun sex and I didn't need the affection or tenderness or love there. And actually, as a result of this experience of being a dominatrix, I've become much more accepting of the fact that that's not really me. You know, it's plenty of people. Like, plenty of people can have open relationships or work in the sex industry and have a totally healthy, functional relationship. But I can't really. I'm actually much more sort of, typically, I'm making little quote marks, conservative sexually than I thought I was. And that's, you know, doing this sort of extreme sexual adventuring ended up leading me to sort of that conclusion that actually I'm much more sort of conventional than I thought I was or than I ever wanted to be.
Well, interesting. You know, your introspection is so valued by me because you know yourself so well, and I'm really glad you've done the search. Rough sex. Rough sex is the kind of sex where you don't necessarily see any intimacy, but because of its dynamics, because of the slapping and the pushing and the screaming and the yelling and the amount of sweat and perspiration that goes out, that could lead to gigantic orgasms, right? You could go off the top. It could never stop. It could be, that's the sexual experience as they talk about it. Then there's another sex, which is tenderness sex, very tender, tender sex. And people tend to call the tenderness sex the affectionate sex and the other sex not affectionate. I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, that's not what I mean. When I'm talking about tenderness, I mean that I have a that I trust that the person I'm having sex with, whatever kind of sex, that they feel tenderness towards me. That there is affection there, that I feel that I'm cared for. That doesn't mean that I'm having caring, very light touch, lighting votive candles and playing meditative music sex. Not at all. You know, I think that rough sex absolutely fits under the umbrella of tenderness. You know, that it's in a relationship where I feel cared for is what I mean by tenderness, I think.
You know, what you talk about, like the rough sex, it kind of reminds me of primal therapy that patients have or clients have with therapists, where there's an unbelievable intimacy that they have with the therapist to allow themselves to open up to that violence that's inside of them.
Mm-hmm. So if you have this kind of sensitive to you, right, then I would dare delve, if you don't mind, since you seem to be 100% open. Therefore, you must be bisexual.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the book...
Good conclusion.
The book concludes with my...
Oh, it does? I'm sorry.
The book concludes with my getting into a relationship with a man and sort of, you know, sort of that was the relationship after leaving this job where I figured out, oh, I want to be in a relationship with someone who loves me, whether we're having rough sex or tender sex, but also that I'm actually not really dominant. In life, I kind of am, but in the bedroom, I'm really not. And I sort of discovered that. But actually, the relationship after that relationship, spoiler alert, I'm actually in a relationship with a woman now.
Okay, so could you mind if I ask? What's the difference? I mean, now you're talking about there's a person that you're in love with. A person. Happens to be a woman. Could that person happen to be a man?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me what the primary difference in you loving a woman versus you loving a man. Is there a specific difference there?
Honestly, I would say that there are differences, but there aren't that many differences, you know, that I think, there are things that I appreciate right now in my relationship that I could attribute, that I was missing in my last relationship, that I could attribute to it being a woman, you know, although I like, very masculine women. I like butch women, and but they're not men, clearly, you know. And sort of, I really do love sort of being in a relationship with someone who can sort of be dominant and play the masculine role, and definitely with someone who sort of plays the dominant role in the bedroom, but who also has a nurturing side, knows how to cook, knows how to take care of you when you're sick. Like a lot of the men I've been involved with just don't. It's not something men are taught. You know, they're not socialized to know how to do those things in many families.
Have you met men and women who are naturally dominant, not dominant because they're angry? They're just, you know, okay, I'm in charge. And if somebody else wants to row the boat, that's fine. Then I'll relinquish the oars. But mostly if I want to get where I'm going to go and I know how to get there best, I'll do the rowing.
Yes, but I want to qualify that with never in all areas of their, like, they're always, for instance, the woman I'm in a relationship now, I think is one of those people who is sort of, you know, peacefully dominant. She's a natural leader, you know, sort of wants to be the director, is very good at delegating tasks to other people, does everything very well and trusts herself more than most other people to do things well, but is okay with letting someone else take the lead and definitely likes sort of being nurtured and affection and is not dominant. She doesn't need it, and it doesn't exist in all parts of her life all the time, but naturally she you know, assumes that role.
Let me ask you a personal question. Sure. If all the other questions have been impersonal so far, do you like to groom her?
Yes.
I know. Could you talk about that?
I have always liked to groom people, and or people I love. You
look
know?
Like a groomer.
I remember when I was probably a teenager, probably in my first sort of love relationship, thinking, wow, it's really kind of miraculous how I could never want to, like, pick the stray hairs or, like, not to be disgusting, but, like, pop a blackhead on someone who I love, you know, or even my dog. Like, I'll go right into my dog's mouth to pull something out, but someone else's dog, no, you know. But I've definitely always had that sort of, like, grooming, caretaking part of me, for sure.
So grooming, when you're grooming your lover, who may be dominant most of the time, your love,
mm-hmm.
When you're grooming, she surrenders.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, the trust is established.
Mm-hmm.
And the very act of grooming, the stroke of the hands, the petting of the hair, the mm-hmm. washing of the face, drops the chemistry all the way down. It does it. It's magic.
Hmm.
Grooming has been part of evolution for ever since.
You know what's really interesting? Because her favorite thing, it's like magic, is head pets. Like petting the head, petting the hair, petting the forehead. And I think that I can just see how someone who is very self-directed and directs other people all day, there has to be some kind of switch so that they can let go of that. And for that, I think you're totally right, that grooming or petting or a massage or whatever, there has to be some sort of switch that often ends up being a physical thing that lets them sort of let go of that.
Exactly, because what we're looking for, again, is we're looking through all of this to affect the chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Just go back to the BDSM stuff, bondage. Mm-hmm. There was always a question of why people like bondage. What is it about bondage? Well, one of the studies that were done showed that there is an enormous amount of endorphins are secreted when you're struggling against ropes.
Mm.
So at the wrists, and at the wrist, if you're struggling that way, endorphins build and build and build, and when there's a climax, it's a much bigger climax.
Mm.
So the whole idea of holding down someone's wrists or tying someone up or someone liking to be tied up is, again, it's another chemical desire that they don't know. It all looks like we're acting out something from childhood.
Mm.
You know, it looks like, oh, you got to beat me because I was a bad kid. But, you know, very rarely, I think, is it just purely that.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody's trying to find their way to a chemical peace inside them, you know, a level of being okay. And if grooming does it, let me recommend to all you people out there, if you like grooming, do more. I wonder if there's anybody who doesn't like being groomed. Have you ever met anybody who doesn't like being groomed?
No, anyone who doesn't like their head being stroked or their hair being brushed or their shoulders being rubbed. No, we love that.
You should be the bride and the groom.
Salons make a lot of money grooming people. They
that's
pay
right.
A lot
and
of
that's
money.
That's my favorite part of getting my... I love the people. My favorite place to go is like Supercuts or the cheap hair places because they're really rough when they rub your hair and they have these women with these long fingernails and they'll sort of maul your head and then put the hot... I love it. I do.
What's been your experience after writing this book and coming out? Mm. I mean, how has it changed your life?
Wow. How hasn't it changed my life?
Yeah.
I mean, I basically went and wrote a book about all of the things that I could never really say out loud to anyone about myself, about my observations about other people, about my own experience. And then so the first time I started talking about it was on radio programs, you know, which I've gotten very used to now. But I mean, overwhelmingly, I've gotten an incredibly warm, supportive response to it. The book came out 3 months ago, and I get emails, multiple emails every day from strangers, from people who've read the book, who say, you know, I had this experience, and a very small portion of them have been dominatrixes or, you know, engage in these sort of S&M practices. For the most part, they're just people who have been ashamed and hidden from their own desires, people who have... people who have shame, who felt sort of released from it because I talked about it in the book. And so it's been incredibly inspiring and rewarding for the most part to have published this. It's also been awkward and scary in a lot of ways because it's been years now since I worked in the industry and I'm now a college teacher and
What do you teach?
I teach writing and literature. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's, you know, I don't talk about the contents of the book in my classes very often, but I know my students read it. And that's also freeing in a way because I'm not proud of everything I've done, but I'm not ashamed of my past, and I think it's on a single continuum, and I'm really glad to be an illustration of that for people that, yes, I can have had this experience and be an addict in recovery and also be a college professor and also, you know, go to bed at 10 p.m. and be very sort of vanilla and normal. And so I really enjoy sort of being that kind of model for people, but it's also been terrifying.
Your parents' response?
My parents are amazing, generous, big-hearted people, and it was incredibly difficult for them to read this book. It's full of a lot of things that no one ever wants to read about their daughter. And I think, you know, the whole while it was happening, my experiences as an addict and as a sex worker, I was very much, as I said before, sort of in control. I never asked for money. I always got straight A's all the way through college. Like, nobody really ever had any idea that it was as intense or as deep or as frightening as it was at times. And so for them, I think it was pretty horrifying. But both of them, when they finished it, said that was one of the hardest books I've ever read in my life, and I'm so incredibly proud of you.
You went through therapy, mm-hmm. obviously, some kind of therapy that really connected for you. Mm-hmm. In the therapy you went through, did it change your attitude towards your work? Is that what got you to quit?
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, insights provided by your therapy?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I started therapy partly because I had this feeling that if I wanted to quit, which I wasn't sure I did at that point, but that maybe I wouldn't be able to. I was so attached to the job and I felt so immersed in it, in that identity and in that world and in what I got out of it. And so I went to a therapist to talk about it. And even in that very first session with my therapist, my perspective on the job changed immensely because she didn't know what a dominatrix was when I walked into the session. And for me, you know, the word dominatrix evoked, you know, it had all of these connotations of being sort of powerful and sexy and glamorous. And a lot of people were really impressed by it and really impressed that I was so seemingly functional and articulate and was also, you know, I loved sort of upsetting people's expectations in that way. But she had no connotations for it. So when I had to describe to her what the job was and I said, okay, well, I go to this place and I, you know, act out these fantasies and I describe them to her. And as I was talking, it was like all of those connotations and all of the sort of like pomp and bravado around it sort of fell away. And I realized, oh, like this is like she might feel sorry for me right now, you know, or she might see this as incredibly dysfunctional, or this might not be what I think it is, you know. And if I let go of all of those connotations and all of that ego stuff around it, what is this for me? And I realized I didn't really know.
So you had to deal with your own resistance, of course, but by doing so, you let yourself surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And you found somebody, a therapist, who you could trust.
Mm-hmm.
And she cared about you.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you're describing a good love relationship, mm-hmm. which is about as curative as it gets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Melissa, thank you very much for being with us. This has been very educational. Is there a website if people want to see the book?
Yes, it's just my name, melissaphebos.com.
Melissaphebos.com. The name of the book, once again, is Whip Smart, my friends. And we'll be back with you soon. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind.
To WBAI New York 99.5 FM. The preceding show, Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, was on recording. If you missed any of it, go to the WBAI.org website in 10 or 15 minutes and the whole thing will be there for you. I am Ken Gale, and coming up next is What's the Frequency, Kenneth? No relation. Followed by Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton at 3, Explorations with Michio Kaku at 5, and the WBAI Evening News at 6. So there's a great lineup coming up, so stay tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, streaming live throughout the internet.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener-sponsored, children. It's commercial-free. Change-a-looia.
You're probably wondering why I'm here, and so am I, so am I.
So, there's this guy. Used to be news director of WBAI, used to be news director of KPFA. Worked for Dan Rather on the evening news for 24 years.
Oh, we can't play that promo. Sorry about that. Go on to the next one.
On Tuesday, July 20th at 2 a.m., Sugar and My Bowl will feature musicians, advocate, and bassist Bob Cranshaw. That's Tuesday, July 20th at 2 a.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
This is Teokas and Ghost Horse, your host for First Voices Indigenous Radio. Join us on WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio, every Thursday at 10 a.m. The energies you will hear are always different, powerful, and not in the habits of entitlement, occupation, and ownership. First Voices Indigenous Radio on WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM, every Thursday at 10 to 11 a.m. It is a center of your radio digits, your radio dial, your radio scanner, and all you have to do is lock it in. They say if you repeat something 3 times, then one will remember it. So, First Voices Indigenous Radio, Thursdays on WPAI New York, Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM. It's a privilege to be here.
The news, uninterrupted, on WBAI. No sports, no weather, no commercials, no distractions. Just the facts. On the award-winning WBAI Evening News, uninterrupted, daily at 6 and 11 on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, Pacifica, radio for a change.
If this were 5 o'clock on a Thursday, that music would mark the beginning of Behind the News. But it's not, so instead I'm here to invite you to join me, Doug Henwood, as I comment on the economic news and interview a wide variety of guests, authors, activists, think tankers, and even the occasional Nobel Prize winner. Economics and politics from New York City to the world, what's happening and what it all means. Behind the News with Doug Henwood, Thursdays from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on WBAI.
Free speech is your right. So exercise it by voting in WBAI's local station board election. The candidates in this election are members just like you who would like to help keep WBAI alive by making important decisions with respect to the budget, overseeing programming, and creating policy. Please don't take this choice lightly. Visit PacificaElections2010.org to find out more about the candidates running so you can make an informed choice. For more information, contact Nicole Justice Hilton at LES_WBAI@Pacifica.org. Ballots must be received by September 30th.